Please be seated. So, Mr. McIndoe, what we're puzzling as between ourselves is, you know, what is the purpose of the AquaLink guideline and any limitations of the AquaLink guidelines vis-a-vis outcomes being sought under Plan Change 7 by any party. And so our exchange has actually been, you know, quite helpful. As I understand it, the AquaLink guidelines produce, for the input for the particular farm type, produce outputs which reflect the reasonable and efficient demand requirements for that farm in relation to water. That's all it does. It's assuming that there's 100% reliability of water supply, which you've agreed with me may not be, is an assumption which is a rebuttable presumption in some years, and it is saying nothing in terms of the area of land to be irrigated. Indeed, the area of land to be irrigated, you said, really was a matter for the farmer. And indeed, the determination of the rate of take is a function of those outputs and area of land to be irrigated. And I think finally you said to me the AquaLink guidelines are also saying nothing about those measures which may need to be taken to provide in some way for the environment, including those matters which are listed as compulsory matters under the NPS, such as ecosystem health, human contact, threatened species and Mahinga Kai. Would that be a fair summary of what it does and what it does not do?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. All right. You also said in your evidence to me, or at least perhaps in questions from the court, that the schedule proposed by the ORC indeed does mimic, it's a pretty good mimic, of the historic actual use of water, but that the schedule outputs don't reflect what the AquaLink guidelines would say is a reasonable use or a reasonable demand or efficient demand for water, correct?
Yeah, I'm mostly concerned about the volume.
About the volume. So, lesser... okay. Now, in your evidence, you have gone for a 48-year record of... I think you call it climate record or weather record. I forgot which way you express it. Climate data, 48 years. Can you tell me why you picked 48 years?
Because climate data was made electronic from 1972, and that's when most of those records are available.
And where have you taken your record from?
It would have been from probably... Well, the available climate stations, they could be Met Service climate stations or they could be through the NIWA network, but they're official climate stations.
And those climate stations, where are their locations?
I think I'll put them in my evidence. Mm. One was Alexandra. Yeah, on in paragraph 38.
38?
Yes.
So paragraph 38. So the weather station is at Alexandra, Windsor and Palmerston?
That's correct.
Yep. And is it your evidence that that is representative of all of Otago or just those areas in Otago?
Well, mainly those areas, but we tried to choose three locations that were different. I'm not trying to represent the whole of Otago here. I'm just trying to select some examples that we can look at to then compare the results with and see how it comes out. So Alexandra, for example, is a low rainfall area.
Mm-hmm.
And Windsor is slightly higher and Palmerston is a more coastal region.
And that 48 period, that would include periods where there has been a global weather oscillation?
Yes.
Such as El Nino, the Southern Oscillation, yeah. or the Pacific Decadal Oscillation?
All those things.
And those weather oscillations also include periods of low rainfall input in Otago.
Yeah, wet years, dry years, in between years, a whole range. And this is the point of my evidence that I'm saying that the 2015 to 2019 seasons don't represent that sort of range.
And the point being the 2015-2019 are not representative of those weather oscillations. And the impact
the
of those, sorry?
Yeah, particularly on the drier years.
In the drier years.
Yes. Five years of record is too short to give you that range.
Now, just getting back to what ORC wants to achieve, particularly in relation to its deemed permits, and putting in place a range of conditions which limit the abstractor either to actual use, well, limit the abstractor to the actual record of take and use either by rates of take or volume. And we've heard your concerns, particularly in relation to volume.
Yes.
That being said, in your experience, is it difficult for applicants for water permits to calculate now the actual area of land that they're currently that is currently under irrigation?
I would expect farmers will have quite a good idea of that. We have to remember that a lot of the takes in Otago are in schemes.
Yeah, tell me about that.
And so, you know, the scheme operators will have a pretty good idea about what the total area is in their schemes. Which actually leads me on to something that's important, and that is that the AquaLink guidelines apply to individual properties, but to convert that data into data for schemes, it requires an amalgamation of the individual property data, plus an adjustment for distribution losses, because it's a scheme, plus other inputs, for example, for frost protection or fruit cooling or stock water or whatever. There's a very good example of that put forward by LandPro in the memorandum, I think, 20th of March.
Is that for Mr. Dunlop's purposes for expert conferencing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, probably I think leave that for Mr. Dunlop rather than take me through that. Okay,
yeah.
So adjustment for losses of scheme and adjustment for other reasons such, well, I mean, the obvious one would be stock water.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
or I guess human, oh, maybe stock water, human water, okay.
So the guidelines give you what you need on individual farms, but for a scheme, the whole thing needs to be amalgamated together to give a flow rate and volume or whatever for the scheme.
Do the guidelines say how to do that?
No, the guidelines don't.
Yeah.
But people like LandPro and AquaLink, even you know, we've got methodologies for doing that.
Mm. So, if it is a purpose of the Regional Council in trying to understand what water is either what water is actually being used or what is a reasonable demand and an efficient allocation of water relative to the area currently under irrigation, then the Aqualink guidelines and together with information either from the consent holder or the scheme operators in relation to the area under irrigation can be readily provided. Would that be right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, yep. It's not difficult. Mm. And it has been done already for a number of schemes.
I don't know whether you can answer this question, but are there some instances for those folk that have deemed permits where they don't have water metering data?
I understand.
Water meters installed, at least, yeah. So they're not talking about technological glitches, but water meters installed.
Yeah, I don't know how many don't have water meters installed. I know they're supposed to.
Yeah.
But that's something that ORC, I'm sure, can tell you.
Just to turn to one particular paragraph of your evidence, paragraph 28, last sentence, you say, however, as stress annual volume limits apply to individual consents are not a substitute for properly considered flow-based allocation limits applied to rivers and streams if environmental protection is the goal. Assuming, Mr. McAdoo, that environmental protection is the goal, at least to achieve the outcomes for compulsory values under the NPS, then what is required to achieve that goal, in your view?
Minimum flows and allocation blocks, flow sharing and all those things that protect the water resource, not annual volumes on resource consents.
And you say that because?
Because putting an annual volume limit on a resource consent has pretty much no impact on the flows of the rivers and streams.
And again, because why, when the water is approaching or is at minimum flow?
Well,
does that annual volume, does the rate of take not itself constrain? No, you tell me why you say that.
Well,
in dry
just
talk,
yeah, annual volumes.
Mm.
Say, for example, the stream gets close to its minimum flow, but you've only used up half of your annual volume, you can still take water.
I see.
The annual volume is there to encourage efficient use of the water, not a control on the impact on the stream. So taking water from a river for irrigation, whatever, stock water or frost protection, has an impact on it. But if you have the appropriate minimum flows and allocation blocks and flow sharing or whatever rules you put in place, then what the river is seeing is stuff to do with flows. It's the flows that have the environmental impact, not something to do with a volume on a piece of paper.
All right. And then the final question from me was in relation to your paragraphs 40 to 43. I didn't really get it, or 43. 40 to 44, I didn't really understand what you were trying to say about percentiles. And can you just take me through it? Because I wasn't sure how to read the subsequent tables. So maybe starting with paragraph 40.
Yeah, yeah.
With your zero percentile.
Yeah, people have been using percentiles in their evidence, which you've seen. I'm not the only one.
No, no, but people use percentiles for different reasons. Yeah. And I suspect your percentile, how you use percentiles, are not the same with Mr. Wilson's use of percentiles. I might be wrong, but I didn't think so.
Yeah, so what I'm talking about is percentiles relating to meeting irrigation demand and the amount of water that you get.
Sorry, I didn't catch all of that. So percentiles to meet irrigation demand, and then I didn't get what you said.
So I've calculated the irrigation demand for these different crops using the 48 years of record, and then summed them up for each year. So if I looked at those 48 numbers, if we're talking about annual volumes, for example, then the zero percentile would be the minimum value in that table. So in every year, that value is equal to or exceeded.
In every year, if you're at a zero percentile, that means in every year what?
Every year, the demand would be equal to that or exceeding that.
Every year will be equal to or exceeding what, though? What value?
The lowest value in the record. Remember, we've got 48 numbers.
Yeah.
One for each season. If we look through and we pick the lowest number, that's the zero percentile.
So if you turn to the tables where this applies or might be applied, can you show me a record with a zero percentile?
No, there are none.
Okay, all right. Well, have you got paragraph number 42? You're talking about a 50th percentile there. Can you show me a record where that percentile applies?
Well, there's some close to 50th percentile.
Can you tell me which ones? Or give me an example. Yep.
In table one, North 55%, Maniototo 54%.
Okay.
Well, that close.
So just pause there a second. No, I've got that. Okay, so how am I meant to read this? So I've got your sentence, percentile of 50% means the volume of water needed for irrigation will exceed this value 50% of the time and be lower than this value 50% of the time. What's the value?
Whatever the value. Where's the 50% stuff here?
Well, look at North.
I haven't given you the value, but...
You haven't given us the value.
Not on that one, but the way to read the tables is we're looking for 90%. In other words, meeting the demand 9 years out of 10.
All right.
So
well,
if you look at the tables and you see any numbers that are less than 90%, then the amount of water that would be available, and this is based on these years of record that the Otago Regional Council took, if they're less than 90%, then the water that's going to be available won't meet the demand in those drier years. And none of them are 90%.
Where the calculation for reasonable and efficient use is over the 48 climate years, correct?
That's right. That's correct.
Which includes periods of dry years, particularly those years responding to global oscillations, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Those are my questions.
Do you realise the question about Ms. Dicey's method?
Oh, yes. Have you been asked to comment on the methodology Miss Dicey has set out to identify rates and volumes in her evidence in chief. Then she was proposing to put it in the water plan. Now she's proposing, I understand, to put it in, you know, into this plan change. But regardless of where it slots, were you asked to comment on that?
No.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
Have you got any comments to make?
If it's the one I'm thinking of, then it's the same methodology essentially that has been put forward in this memorandum we're going to discuss tomorrow.
We've got another memorandum to come, do we?
No, the memorandum was put out on Saturday, on the 20th.
Ms. Irving's just going to pop up and say something.
Yes. So in preparation for the conference, there's been a memorandum produced.
Yes.
And just to clarify, ORUG and LandPro have essentially agreed that their methods are the same. So the LandPro method has essentially been adopted by ORUG for the purposes of the conferencing moving forward.
Okay, well, that's helpful. Does that... only for the conference or by way of relief?
By way of relief.
Well,
in essence, the two methods are the same, articulated in slightly different terms. So for the to try and minimise the work for the conference and streamline it, we've agreed that the LandPro method would
suffice.
Be adopted.
Yep. Okay, all right. So that's good. So I won't ask you any questions because it's going to come up in the expert conference. And it appears now that the methodology ORAG had put forward in Ms. Dicey's evidence is not being pursued as advised by Ms. Irving. So that's helpful. Got any questions? You don't feel the need. Okay, right. Very good. Those are our questions. Now, anyone, any questions arising as a consequence of the court's questions? All right. Right. All right, well, Mr. McIndoe, you've got to get onto a plane and get down here for your expert conferencing. That's been really helpful. I really appreciate your time ahead of that conference as well. Thank you very much. You're
I was interested in at 8 o'clock this morning.
Yeah. Yeah, you nearly got there. All right, very good.
Okay, all good. Thank
Cheers.
You.
Cheers. Bye. Okay.
I think what happens next is I call Mr. Hickey, Mum.
God, that the evidence you're about to give in the matter before this court will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank
you. Thank you.
You all right?
Yes.
Okay.
You're all right?
It's a health and safety incident.
Is your full name Matthew Aaron Hickey?
Yes, it is.
And do you have the qualifications and experience set out in paragraphs 1 to 13 of your brief of evidence?
Yes, I do.
And do you confirm that that brief of evidence is true and correct to your knowledge and belief?
Yes, I do.
Now, on page 2 of your evidence, Mr. Hickey, you have prepared a summary running to some 8 bullet points. Do you wish to read that?
I can, but I can take it as read if it's
Does
useful.
It assist the court if he reads the summary, ma'am?
It would.
Mr. Hickey, if you wouldn't mind reading the summary on page 2 of your evidence, And then I have some supplementary questions to ask you arising from what we've just been hearing from Mr. McIndoe.
Yes. ORC claims that it has unreliable data and insufficient knowledge to implement the MPSFM 2020 immediately. The evidence from ORC and ORAG technical experts does not support this. The evidence of Mr. DePalsamaker paints a bleak picture of ORC's current data and knowledge, and this does not seem plausible based on the evidence of Mrs. Henderson, Olsen, Alibone and myself. The time between now, which is now March 2021, and notification in December 2023 of the new Land and Water Regional Plan does not give ORC time to rectify the data issues identified by Mr. DePalsamaker. ORC's proposed approach to acquiring the technical information required for sensitive and high-value catchments, such as the Otago Lakes, is unlikely to be appropriate because it does not prioritise ecological risk. Contrary to Mr. DePalsamaker's view, the evidence from both ORC and ORAG's experts suggests that in relation to the main catchments covered by Plan Chain 7, where deemed permits dominate, there is sufficient data and knowledge to implement the MPSFM 20 without delay, without the delay offered by PC7. The key tools for managing the effects of abstraction on the compulsory values of the MPSFM 2020, Indigenous ecosystems, threatened fish and Mahinga Kai species, are available under the operative Regional Plan Water and not Plan Chain 7. The process for assessing applications under the operative Regional Plan has, in my experience, resulted in good ecological outcomes, and in direct contradiction to the MPSFM, delaying proper ecological assessments of water takes for at least the next 6 years may result in further losses of non-migratory Galaxis populations.
Thank you. Now, Mr. McIndoe was asked questions about the risk of flatlining in catchments in Otago relative to allocation block sizes. Do you recall that evidence, those questions?
Yes.
To your knowledge, are hydrographs available for the catchments for which deemed permits currently exist?
For the majority, or for many of them, yes.
And if those hydrographs were studied, would they demonstrate whether flatlining is occurring in those catchments under the status quo arrangements?
It would demonstrate that at times there is low flows and that there is a high degree of variability in flows.
Do you have any comment to make about whether there is a connection between the setting of allocation blocks and the risk of flatlining river flows in a catchment?
In general, I agree with the comments by Mr. McIndoe. My experience is not really around the size of the allocation block, but how that water is used and the distribution within a catchment of how that water is taken and when that drives the resultant flow regime.
Have you got any observations to make about using the Manaherikia catchment as an example?
I probably wouldn't use the Manaherikia. There is no minimum flows, and most of the permits that extract water are from tributaries, and there's no residual flows on those takes either. So, yeah, it's probably not ideal.
I want to come now to questions about irrigation methods, and Mr. McIndoe was asked questions about the relative efficiency of spray versus surface flood types of irrigation, and Mr. McIndoe's observation was that spray methods are gradually replacing surface flow methods of irrigation in Otago. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Why would a farmer continue to be using surface flow irrigation methods instead of spray?
The two obvious reasons that I encounter firstly, not been sure of the outcome of going through the consent process and this kind of process. So there's been a lack of willingness to invest in that infrastructure, and they want to wait and see in some cases. And the other cases were around reliability of supply. So generally now where we see overland flow used, it's where reliability of supply is much lower than is required for spray irrigation. So on the shoulder seasons, often say spring into maybe early summer, there would still be some flood irrigation or water dike irrigation. But where the reliability of supply is adequate, generally people have moved from to spray, such as K-line or centre pivots.
Okay. Can you explain why reliability of supply is important, or more important for spray irrigation methods than surface flood methods?
So spray methods rely on putting a little bit of water on over the whole season, just keeping soil moisture at a certain level, whereas with water dike systems, they often have, or flooded systems, they rely on putting a lot of water on at once when it's there, and then not coming back around and putting any water on sometimes for a month or so later. So they're quite different approaches.
Compared, for example, Canterbury irrigation schemes, do you have any observation to make about reliability of irrigation supply in Otago?
In my limited experience with Canterbury and knowing what I know in Otago, we generally have less reliability than some of the, well, a lot of the schemes in Canterbury.
Lastly, Mr. McIndoe made comments about the irrigation intake infrastructure making it difficult to rapidly respond to river levels, which would enable rivers to be held at minimum flow. Have you got any comment to make from your familiarity with irrigation infrastructure in Otago?
I think obviously it's different across the whole region, different infrastructure, but in principle I agree with what he's saying. It's very hard, I've not seen it be done where a catchment can specifically hold a flow for weeks or months at a certain flow by managing their irrigation infrastructure. I've not seen that happen. In Otago.
Okay. And if that were happening in Otago, would that be apparent from the hydrograph records that the regional council keep?
Yep, but you would have to be careful that what you were looking at wasn't a result of just lack of rain, given central Otago is arid. You know, it's not uncommon to have no rain for 3 months during the summer, which of course will result in low flows, which are essentially, I guess, what people are trying to say is flatlined. So you'd have to be able to differentiate the environmental background that flow regime is responding to as well.
Yes. But if you were comparing those hydrographs with irrigation take data for a catchment, do you think that analysis is possible?
Yes.
Thank you. Nothing further, Mark.
Mr. Moore.
Your Honour. I want to start at the end of your evidence, not the beginning, so if I can take you to your paragraph 120.
Yes.
And at the very end of your very last sentence, you note that when the science basis for achieving Tamana O2Y through permit renewals exists now. When you say science basis, what do you mean in this context?
So I mean, having the hydrology and ecological ability to make ecosystem or decisions based on providing for ecosystems now.
So when you think about setting an environmental flow regime, you accept that the ecological flow is just one component of an environmental flow regime?
I accept it as a component, but it has some form of compulsory attribute to it under the MPS, so it's given a bit more weight now than it, I guess, historically had been.
But it's not given exclusive or full weight? It doesn't trump other values?
No, but you wouldn't set a flow for the other values that didn't provide for the ecological outcome.
So is it your opinion that an ecological flow would provide for all other values?
No, but I think you could set a flow for other values that didn't necessarily provide for ecological values, but it would be more likely that you would go some way to providing for the other values if you at least had the ecological values sorted.
So you might go some way, but not all the way, to provide for other values?
Not in all cases, no.
And when you think of those other values, what is it that you have in mind?
I guess recreation, potentially. Some values, say kayaking or something at higher flows. That kind of thing.
Yes, what about cultural values?
Yep, there potentially is cultural values that are different to ecological.
And you might need higher flows to protect cultural values?
That's possible, yep.
Do you have any understanding or familiarity with the concept of cultural indicators of health?
Yes.
And can you describe for the court some examples of cultural indicators of health?
So, the way the river looks, I guess, is one of the fundamentals, with periphyton and things like that. How it sounds, yeah, those sorts of things.
And the way in which those values might be protected may require flows higher than ecological flows to remain in a river system.
Potentially, yes.
So when you say that the science basis for achieving Te Mana Ōtu Wai exists now, is it perhaps better to say that the science basis for some of the values exists now?
I think that's fair comment, and I should have said that for achieving the ecological component of Te Mana Ōtu Wai now.
Is it your understanding that under the NPSFM 2020 that there is a process that the council needs to go to with respect to understanding all of the compulsory values?
Not sure about the compulsory values, as in the threatened fish, Mahinga Kai and ecosystem.
Yes, in fact, we'll go back a step. The community needs to go through a process to identify the values that are important to it.
Yes, I understand that, yeah.
And the NPS requires significant engagement with tangata whenua in relation to understanding cultural values?
Yes.
And that work is underway in the Otago region, as far as you're aware?
I think so.
But it's not yet complete?
I don't know how far through that it is, no.
So when you refer to the... I want to take you to your paragraph 105. And here you say that in your experience, limit setting under permit renewals and the NPSFM 2020 is effectively the same exercise and requires the same data. You then go on to note that each water body is different and has different values. Now, when you think about the process that the community needs to go through to identify the values that are important to it, how is it that that can occur through the lens of a one-off resource consent application?
I think I may not have written that very well. What I was suggesting is that the data that you're going to require to get through the MPSFN 2020, what's required by 2023, and what's been used or put forward in, say, the Manuhiri Care as a group application, will have to be the same data. We don't have time to really get any other data. And that when you're assessing whether you're meeting some of those values, you're running through the same kind of assessment.
Do you accept that that relates to the ecological and hydrological considerations?
Yes.
And so when we think about cultural values and recreational values, that work's yet to be done, isn't it?
I think it's been done in the Manuhiri Care. So I'm pretty sure there's cultural assessment being done and a recreational assessment being done.
So you're understanding that PC7 applies just to the Manuhiri Care catchment or across the Otago region?
Across the catchments that have got deemed permits and consents coming up, yes. So I was just using the Manuhiri Care as an example that I know of where that information is available.
But that information hasn't been captured in the way that the NPSFM 2020 now requires it to be captured, has it?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
So the process under the NPSFM, and tell me whether this is straying into planning territory, but you have given evidence in relation to the NPSFM. So in relation to the values that need to be identified and recorded as long-term visions in a regional policy statement, that process hasn't completed yet, has it?
Not that I know of, no.
And so all of the information that's necessary across the Otago region in terms of understanding the values isn't yet complete, is it?
All the data collection, or I'm not sure what...
Let's approach it in this way. Let's assume all of the science, the technical science, is complete. That's not enough, though, is it? There still needs to be an assessment in relation to cultural values across the region.
Yeah.
And there would need to be an assessment in relation to recreational values.
Yes.
And values touching on amenity. Sorry, I didn't catch.
Yes, sorry. I thought you had another.
And natural character.
Yes.
And so in relation to those values, given that they haven't yet been articulated and identified?
Through the RPS, you mean?
Yes, or through a regional plan?
No.
So how is it that a consent applicant understands how to approach those values?
I guess from the perspective that I've approached this is that we've been expected to give regard to the MPS through the Regional Council asking us to for our consent applications. So in my mind, we've tried to do that, and I acknowledge it won't be the full approach that you were talking about, but it has been an expectation that we at least try in lodging those consents.
So it is difficult when the community hasn't yet established the values that it considers are important and need to be protected.
No. Yeah, it is difficult, like you say, but I don't believe that that means we shouldn't try to at least try and prove things that we know are not as good as they should be. And that's, I guess, the approach we've taken. But yeah, acknowledge what you're saying.
To take you to your table 2 on page 13. And here you've listed the data available in relation to the deemed permit catchments and information available. Now, can you clarify, does this table relate, in fact it's there, it's in relation to the Manaherikia, Cadrona and Arrow catchments? And in your table, is there any data available in relation to cultural considerations or cultural values?
In my table?
Yes.
No.
Recreational values?
No.
Natural character?
No.
And amenity?
No.
I want to discuss with you now the relevance of allocation blocks and allocation of water. So when you think about, for example, the suite of applications that have been lodged in relation to the Manaherikia catchment, are you familiar with those applications?
Yes.
You've had a hand in drafting them, I understand?
Yes.
So in terms of that process, you've identified a block of water or an allocation of water that is available for abstraction?
Yes.
And in terms of the applications lodged, they seek to abstract the entirety of that allocation that's been identified.
In what way?
In the sense that you accept that the applications have been framed with some what I'll describe as ecological minimum flow conditions.
Yes.
And then all water above that is sought by way of application for the various uses in the catchment.
Yes.
So when you think about those applications, let's assume that they are all granted for the duration that's been sought. And can you confirm the duration that has been sought for those applications?
I think it was 35 years, but I'm not 100% sure.
So 35 years. Let's assume that water is allocated out so that those applications are granted for the 35-year period. When you think about the council's role, and you accept that the council has a role in terms of determining an allocation regime...
Yes.
And water can be allocated to a range of uses, can't it?
Yes.
So water could be allocated for agricultural purposes?
Yes.
Could be allocated for cultural purposes?
Potentially, yes.
Hydroelectricity generation?
Yes.
Community TAPEs?
Yes.
So the effect of allocating out all the water available in the Manaherikia for 35 years for these applications would deprive the council of the opportunity to consider whether allocations should be made for those other uses, wouldn't it?
Would depend. It would depend on the allocation block in the new land and water regional plan.
But if all the water's been allocated out to these uses, there wouldn't be any left, would there?
Well, I don't know, because I don't know what that block is. So, yeah, it's... If you assume that there's no possible way of increasing the allocation block going forward, then yes, you're right. But I don't know if that's...
So you don't know whether the water that's been sought in these applications is the full extent of the allocation block available?
Well, at the moment, there's further allocation available for high flow harvesting, so there potentially is still allocation available.
But potentially only at those high flow levels?
Depending on what those levels get set at.
To take you to paragraph 61 of your evidence, and in this section you address the NPSFM and Te Mana o Te Wai.
Yes.
Now, having read your qualifications and experience, am I correct in understanding that you don't have any planning qualifications?
Yes.
So when I read your evidence in relation to the interpretation of Te Mana o Te Wai, that's coming from your experience as a hydrologist and or ecologist?
I think, to be clear, the way I've written this is to try explain the approach that I've taken from an ecology perspective and trying to give regard to the NPSFM. So trying to set out like the logic of why we're putting in a residual flow, what the specific values are that we're trying to address with that, so that it can be tested.
So what you've done is you've picked out objective 2.11A of the NPSFM, so the first matter in the hierarchy, and as you read that part of the objective, do you understand that, or is it your interpretation that that relates to ecological aspects of health of a river?
I've used the ecological component as that's my expertise in interpreting that part of the objective.
Except that that is one component of the assessment?
Yes.
And the NPSFM recognises that, doesn't it? In terms of the approaches to implementing the National Policy Statement and Clause 3.2, where it addresses Te Mana o Te Wai?
I don't have that clause in front of me, sorry.
We can provide you a copy, Ms. Harlow, MPS. Sorry, which clause are you referring to?
3.2.
It's
page 9 of the NPS. It helps. Sorry, I tell a lie. Page 11.
Yeah, I've got it in front of me now.
And there you'll see subparagraph 2 sub D, the very last one on the page.
Yes.
NAT recognises that there's a need to enable the application of a diversity of systems of values and knowledge, such as Matauranga Māori, to the management of freshwater.
Yes.
And so when we look at the objective and we look at subparagraph A, first, the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems, there's more to it than simply looking at the ecological component, isn't there?
Yes.
Are you familiar with the concept of kia te kitai?
Broadly, yes.
So just your understanding of the concept at a broad scale?
I'd have to refer to the definitions, I think, in the MPS, but I don't have a working knowledge.
Except that it recognises the interconnectedness of resources.
Yeah.
And the need to take an integrated approach to the management of resources.
Yes.
Except that there's a connection between land use and water quality.
Yes.
And a connection, therefore, between the use to which irrigation water is put and potential effects on water quality.
Yes.
And taking a holistic view, it's important to understand both the components that deal with water quality and quantity.
Yes.
And in terms of your understanding of the Otago region, do you accept that there's limited information available at the present time in relation to the current land use pattern?
No.
Is it your evidence that there's complete knowledge of the land uses that are currently taking place?
Well, I would say you would never have complete knowledge because land use can change quite rapidly, but there is good knowledge of different land uses and where they occur in the region.
Except that when it comes to allocating water, it's important to understand the pattern of land use.
Potentially, yes.
And it's important to understand that pattern of land use because of potential effects on water quality.
Yes.
And based on your experience, the current planning framework in Otago is ill-equipped to consider the effects of land use on water quality.
Well, it's all basically been delayed, hasn't it? Yes.
Those are my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're going to take the adjournment, take a 15-minute break, have a cup of tea, and then get back to it. With you, Miss Lennon, I think, your questions after the morning, after the afternoon adjournment.
I've got no questions, Your
Honour. No, that was easy.
Thank you.
Who's up next? All right. I had you, Miss Williams. You're next. Okay, all right, after the afternoon adjournment. Thank you.
All rise.